welcome to Phoenix Vision with Jess Farmer. Today I have on the show a very special guest, one of my all-time best friends, Gavin Symes, that I have known and very happy to call my friend for the last God knows how many years. So Gav is an occupational therapist in Melbourne and runs a business called Wizard OT, which helps many people in a very dynamic and holistic way. So we took a real big expose on chronic pain. We spoke about Gav's business as well as the biopsychosocial model of treating patients. So this is a really packed episode, great chronic pain information, and yeah, it's quite a funny dialogue between us as well. So I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to Phoenix Vision. I am here with one of my best friends in the world, Mr. Gavin Symes. Hello, my brother. How are you doing? You all right?
I'm good, thank you. Like I was just saying before we started recording, I'm getting into Melbourne, which is quite a well-known city in Australia, life. And just enjoying not being in lockdown, engaging in two of my most meaningful occupations. And that doesn't just mean work, which we can go into obviously on this episode. So that's cycling, because the cycle paths here are to die for, not literally, hopefully, and street art graffiti stuff. So yeah, I'm loving it. And also it's quite a different weather system to Sydney. So Sydney, Australia, where I lived for 5 years, that's often very, very hot with crazy rainstorms. Here in Melbourne, I don't know if you've ever heard the Crowded House song, Four Seasons in One Day. No, Four Seasons in One Day. That's a reference to Melbourne, because the weather can change at the drop of a hat. So you leave wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and then you'd be coming back wearing a flipping ski suit because it's that cold. So, yeah.
Right, yeah. Now we've had the Aussie weather report, let's crack on then.
How English of me. I'll move to the other side of the world and let's talk about the weather.
So, my very good friend Gav to our friends.
You like.
Very good friend Gav is an occupational therapist and founder of Wizard OT. So Wizard OT is doing some amazing works with their clients in Melbourne, Australia. Gav uses a holistic approach to assist people address their physical and mental health difficulties through direct therapy services, as well as through his street art therapy groups.
Oh, you've looked at the website.
Yeah, of course, mate.
Prepared. You've actually prepared, which is very. I've actually gone on your website and looked at the stuff that's on there. Thanks.
Yeah, it's organised these days, mate. Right, mate, I already know your story, but for the benefit of the listeners, can you give a rundown of your journey into occupational therapy and what led you into working with others, as well as like general life journey?
All right. Okay, so this is gonna go pretty heavyweight. So I'm just going to do something which I'm always talking with clients about, just a bit of breath work, tiny bit of breath work. So we're going to do some longer exhales. I'm going to get that proprioceptive. No, wrong thing. That's a terrible fail. Parasympathetic nervous system. The reason I say proprioceptive is I've been like super geeking out on Andrew Huberman's podcast, all about motor learning. And he literally says proprioception about 5 million times in one of the episodes.
Actually, the breathing is one of the chief proprioceptive regulators of the system anyway. So no, you're right.
Interrelated system of systems. Okay, so just a couple.
Come on, mate, get on with it.
Right, okay. Hey, I'm about to really put my whole heart on the line. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be 100% truthful. So my journey into occupational therapy, so I think the reason why I was doing that tiny bit of breath work is I'm going to talk about, you know, I'm not really necessarily the stereotypical went to, so in the UK, I grew up in England, in the outskirts of London. Tell anyone from actual inner London that it's outskirts of London, they're like, that ain't London. That's not London, mate. I was like, all right, okay, sorry. I wasn't really the kind of academic sort of person. I very much got into a lifestyle of like heavy drinking and recreational hard drug use and stuff like that. And, you know, just had jobs that I never really liked, but I always had a part of me where I really wanted to help other people. I didn't quite know what that was going to be. And then I think I was working a sales job. It was like life insurance sales by phone. And it's like, if there's anything more soul destroying than cold calling people, telling them they need to buy something, but the only time they'll use it is when they're dead, is really soul destroying. And I don't like forcing people to buy things if they don't want it. I was like a terrible salesperson because they go, I don't want it. I go, all right, thanks. That'll be it. So that was kind of the end point. And one of my ex-girlfriends was studying something called occupational therapy. And I was like, what's that? She explained, it's essentially having people, and this is a very simplistic explanation of what occupational therapy is. It's helping people do the things they like doing as the therapy. I thought, what the hell does that mean? Anyway, I then realized I needed to go pretty much back to basics and really study. I had to do an access course to then get into university. It took me a fair while because I hadn't done any academic stuff since I was 17, 18. So this was in my late 20s. And I finally got into the University of West of England in Bristol and studied occupational therapy. Now, the thing with studying occupational therapy is it's the name that whoever gave occupational therapy, I'm sure it wasn't one person, they've really done themselves a mischief because if I say to you occupation, what do you think that, what does that instantly make you think?
Job.
Yeah, exactly. And PM goes, oh, that's occupational health. And you're like, no, it's not. So quick 30, 60 second elevator pitch of what occupation means. I think defining that is super important before we actually, you know, dig into what I now do or what I actually have decided to do through Wizard OT. So the term occupation means anything someone needs to do, wants to do, or is expected to do. So, you know, well, that is very vague and very broad. But also it's things, the clue is in the name, it's occupying your time. So when we say things we need to do, I always use myself as an example. Something we need to do is I need to get up and, well, I don't have to, but get up, have a shower, brush my teeth, have a black coffee, cycle to work. Although I don't cycle to work, that's just an example. Want to do, cycle, go to a gym, do my painting stuff, do amazing podcasts with people like you. And then expected to do is like pay my rent, not uppercut someone on the street at random. You know, it's very vague. And these, what occupations actually are dependent on that person's individual needs. Now, when you then think of those need to do, want to do, expected to do, if someone has mental health issues, physical health issues, trauma, socioeconomic difficulties, literally anything, that can really impact on their ability to carry out their occupations. So if we think of something we need to do, say it would be to be able to get out of bed. If you just had a hip replacement, being able to get out of bed is going to be quite difficult for a fair while. An occupational therapist might work with someone to give them some assistive technology. So, you know, things, something like a commode or like a grab stick or a sock aid. These are all real things. I'm not making these up. And that was one of my first jobs. It was like giving someone a commode, giving them something to get their sock on. That sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? Get your sock on. To get your sock on. Get your sock on, lad. And then that was kind of impacting for that. But then if we think about mental health issues, so again, this idea that the mental and physical is separate, you know, you and I were on a very similar wavelength. We know they're not separate. They are, you know, you've got the body, you've got the brain, and then you've got the mind, and that's all interrelated. And mental health issues. So if you're really, really depressed, just as an example, your desire to get out of bed is going to be really impacted. Your desire to go and hang out with people, you're feeling mega anxious. So, you know, All our occupations, which are very individualized and very much important to us as a person, on a very, very individual level, although often it's quite often pigeonholed and it's like, this is occupational therapy and this is occupational therapy. I don't really follow that mindset. And if you think about even something like trauma, you know, how that can impact on our ability to, say, interact with other people or feel safe or be hypervigilant, it can really impact, you know, go to work, you know, deal with work environments, all that type of stuff. So that was way longer than a 30 to 60 second elevator pitch. But that gives an example of how broad occupational therapy is. Now, in most settings, clinical and otherwise, community, hospital, there's OTs everywhere. But it's one of those professions where OTs kind of just get on with it. Because actually, in general, I found a lot of OTs, not all of them, are very dedicated, creative people, but they don't really kind of shout their own, you know, blow their own horn as such, because it's kind of just get on with the job. But I'm just going to blow my own horn. That sounds a bit dodgy as well, doesn't it? Get your sock on and blow your own horn. Thank you. So does that give you more of an idea of what OT actually is?
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, I remember when you were studying, because I had the great pleasure of living with you for, I don't know, like 4 years or something. Mm-hmm. And I your journey's just been so inspiring, man. Like really, really, because I saw it right from the beginning when you were when you first started studying and you worked a job that you didn't want to work to get through the study. And like, I just like saw like the dedication, the work. And then when you started working with your clients and patients and some of the stuff that some of the difficult things you were coming across there, is just and just to see your journey and what you've created and what you've made from it is like super inspiring. So yeah, I just want to say big ups for that, mate. Because I've seen the whole journey, so it's freaking rad.
We just turn that into like a montage of just me, just you know, I gotta do a montage, and I'm like sitting there, like,
you got the power,
like, you got the wizard touch, yeah! And I'm just there, like in the dark, kind of like really just wiping the sweat off my brow, writing, like drinking coffee, and out running, listening to podcasts, and then it's just me at the top of the steps with a degree certificate going, yeah, and I freeze in just jumping up with a degree certificate. Yeah, and then it's like the sequel, and then it's like, now you've got your OT degree, now you're going to really learn about the world.
I just imagine in the standstill Philadelphia shot.
Just with an occupational therapy degree in my hand, me just jumping in the air looking really excited, and then it's like the follow-up, and then it's I'm like competing against a Russian OT.
Yeah, mate.
and then I become a well-known OT, and actually then there's a guy on the street, he's like the newcomer, and he wants to challenge me, and he's like, I can do better clinical interventions than you. I bet I can use better assessment tools than you. And I'm just like complacent. I'm like, outcome measures, what are you talking about?
I'm learning loads about OT. I didn't realise it was so close to boxing.
Yeah, well, that can be an incredibly important occupation for many people. If we think about the myriad of benefits of, say, something like that, then, you know, boxing is often seen as a very violent, not very thought through type of thing. But if we think about belonging, community, engagement, fine motor skills, gross motor skills, coordination, stamina building, like belonging, being part of a group, then becoming a mentor to other people, it's a multifaceted occupational, but I'm seeing it through what I call the occupational lens. Because I tell you what, mate, it took, this is no word of a lie, for at least the first year of doing that undergraduate degree, no one really understood what occupation meant, because it's so broad and it's so complex that it's almost like you need to dive straight in. That scene in what's the film? Trainspotting. You know, he like jumps into the toilet and it's just like, yeah. And that's essentially what an OT undergrad or master's is. And you're like, I'm lost in the toilet. I don't really understand what OT is. And then you like burst out and you're like, it basically means everything.
Yeah. So anyway. I've got a couple of questions on that. So my first question is, if you could rename occupational therapy, would you, and what to? And my second question is, what does wizard OT might do differently to standard occupational therapy approach? What is different about wizard OT is the question, basically.
All right. So I like the first one, because we actually used to talk about that a lot on the course. We were like, someone, and the lecturers who were very experienced OTs that RIP, those two of the lecturers that I studied with, actually have passed away. So RIP to them, because they were my two favourite lecturers. Anyway, that's going off on a tangent. Anyway, so what would we rename it? I guess doing stuff therapy. That was what I came up with, like just doing stuff, because it is doing stuff. Yeah. I think the term occupation is so confusing. It really doesn't help the profession. Meaningful engagement therapy. But again, these are very broad, vague terms. I think the doing stuff is like, because it is literally doing stuff, but it wouldn't look very good, would it? Like physical therapist, Czech practitioner, speech pathologist, doing stuff therapist. You'd be like, what is this? I guess that's the eternal question.
It kind of feels like to me though that, you know, it's so much more than just doing stuff, because it's like I know you as a person, you're such an empathetic, caring, loving person, and mm-hmm. you know, that in terms of what you bring to your work, that aspect of it is I imagine going to be so important for the support of the client or patient, because you know, I imagine it's so much more than just doing stuff with someone. You know, they are looking to you as a supporter, to be a rock, and to ultimately help them when they're struggling with a myriad of different complex, a lot of the time, hard to work out, difficult to deal with life situations.
And that's why it's so difficult to kind of pigeonhole it. You know, I think people may have encountered occupational therapists. So the most common things I get is, occupational therapy. Most people just kind of, I give them that elevator pitch and their eyes just glaze over. They're like, why the hell did I ask? Because I'm super passionate about being an OT. I think, you know, some people, they study and they work out what they want to do as a job, because I had no life goals, really. I just basically was more into just like doing drugs and drinking and didn't really have a life goal. And I found OT and I'm still so passionate about it because I honestly think it's one of the most... I'm biased and I'm mega biased. I'm very aware of that. But trying to then put it into a pigeonhole, which is, I think, why you and I, we can resonate so well with what we do. The other thing, like I was going to say, is that, you know, people are an occupational therapist. Yeah, my son saw an occupational therapist once. Is that what OTs do? Work with children? Like, yeah, some of them do. And then people say, dad was in an accident and had to spend time in hospital, or my dad had a stroke or whatever. And then the occupational therapist, is that what you do? And I always say, yeah, that's one type of OT. But and that's the you know, the shortened down OT. But we had a lecturer and I didn't really get it at the time. She was like, I won't do her accent, that's a bit harsh. I was gonna do a Scottish accent. She was like, hardcore.
The accent, mate.
Don't call it OT. Call it occupational therapy. Don't call it OT. And someone would say OT, and she'd just look over and go, don't call it OT. And I didn't really get why. But now I understand, because it's like OT, OT. It's like, it's one of the professions where it can be very quietly, we just do our thing. But actually the way that I look at the world and the way that other OTs, not all of them, because again, you know, you can get your own, whatever you want out of a course, a training course, an online course, a quick course. You know, you can really, and I'll be honest, I struggled so hard with studying because I can't stand studying something I don't have interest in. And I'm sure that's most people, but I nearly quit that course so many times, and it was a hardcore course. You have to go do placements as well. So where you have to actually go and be an OT basically as a trainee, and they're not easy. They're really hard because also you're always, you've got a practice educator and you've always got to be on the ball. You've always got to look like you can handle it. You've always got to be able to not go to people's stag parties in Devon and then try and start your second or third placement like I did, which was, again, I was still in that life period where I was trying to get myself out of those old thought patterns, those old behavioural patterns, which were hardwired into me for many, many reasons, which I didn't really address until my 30s. But I guess what I love about OT is you know, they really drummed into us how it's holistic. Mm. Think of the person, and like we were going to talk about. So I'll just address your other question. How is Wizard OT different? So I'll give you a very quick I always say that, it's like 9 minutes later. You're like, yeah, all right, that was not a quick story. So moved here. I won't talk about where I worked in the UK, but before I became an OT while I was studying, I was also a support worker. So I did support work with people with intellectual disabilities, maybe a diagnosis of autism, mental health, because I've always had an interest in the complexity of the human organism. I've never just wanted to work with one set of people because I don't think people can be pigeonholed. Or you have this diagnosis, or you have this diagnosis. Well, no, that's a collection of symptoms that have been provided to you by a medical professional at the DSM-5. That doesn't define you as a person. That's just one thing to establish, which we both agree on, I'm sure. And long story short, I'd got to a point where I just felt like I wasn't able to do the holistic, broad thinking, creative, because I'm a creative person as well, being able to be creative and create interventions very individualized. And essentially it got to the point where I managed a service. It was initially pediatrics, and I'd also worked somewhere for a long period where they marketed me as this like specialist sensory processing trauma focused, all these buzzwords. But I was just devouring more and more information. I was going on long training courses. I was doing online courses. And I just never felt like I was able to actually express. Okay, so it's like, I think what's evolved over time is that the holistic, because no holistic gets chucked around all over the place, doesn't it?
Oh,
yeah, we're holistic. We're client-centered. We're person-centered. They're just buzzwords. They're just buzzwords of companies. It's like, I don't know if you've ever noticed this. A lot of companies call themselves really dull names, like Global Mega Rehab Corp or that. That sounds like Homer Simpson made that up. Shout out to Homer Simpson. Shout out to the Simpsons. I think there's a lot of generic money-making churning through clients things. So it's like definitely with the NDIS now, it's like do an assessment, write a report. That's $2,000. Company gets most of the money. Next, 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 next. And I've never liked that process. I've always liked the maybe if required, do an assessment of someone's current needs, depending on what their NDIS plan is. Maybe if they're private, they're paying it themselves, meet them where they're at and then assess and then do the intervention. That's why I became an OT, not to write reports. I want to do interventions. And gradually over time, my knowledge base and my understanding of what holistic really means, and what the biopsychosocial approach is, because they drummed that into us at uni. And I'm so pleased they did, because then that viewpoint, that biological, psychological, and social perspective means that I view the client as a very much an individual. The difference with Wizard OT is, and this is where having to go independent was required, because I look at, you know, the foundations of health, what someone eats or drinks, how they sleep, stress management, their exercise, their movement, their community, their belonging, the actual physical environment. What are the barriers to them engaging in occupation? Is it they're living in a supported independent living place and the support workers are just actually quite mean? That's one of the things I found really difficult is the most vulnerable people in society are often supported by people that are undertrained, underskilled, and often been through a lot of trauma themselves. And I find that I'm often told that my approach is a breath of fresh air. And, you know, you kind of think, well, what is everyone else doing? Like,
everyone should just be doing what I'm doing at the level that I'm doing it.
Like, why are people not considering like trauma and mental health and physical health and sleep and rest and, you know, meaningful engagement and how important it is to understand people's life history and like how you can go like top down and bottom up and all this type of stuff. And it's like, they're like, wow, that's, I've never heard that. And you're like, what the fuck are other people doing then? So did that actually answer the question?
No, that was fantastic, mate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's, it's given me a really good idea. I think I've known for a long time that, you know, there's the industry is in need of a lot more people like yourself, because I know how you work. I know your diligence. I know your body of study. So no, that's great. Actually, I was going to do this question like a little bit later on, but since you've already mentioned it, it's probably a good time to actually start unpacking it now. But yeah, it'd be great to unpack the biopsychosocial model with you somewhat, as I feel this is one of the big keys when it comes to treating chronic pain. So first of all, what is it? How can we use it as a means of understanding the etiology and therefore treatment of a client or patient?
Yeah.
Do you feel that this helps develop the connection and bond in a different way to other models, to the patients, if you are thinking in this way?
Okay. I'm just going to write those down because there's a couple of questions there.
There's a big question. So if you want some refreshes, let me know.
So it's like essentially, so you're saying like define the biopsychosocial approach. Does it create more of a connection and a bond between, let's say, a clinician or a therapist and the client or participant or service user, or as I like to say, human being or person? Oh my God, you call them a person. Okay, so let's just define that. So I did a bit of prep, not much prep, but explain pain is anyone that's interested in chronic persistent pain. So I'll give a quick overview of the chronic persistent pain stuff. Why I find it really important is I've experienced chronic persistent pain now for ages, but we can go back into that. So let's define the biopsychosocial. So,
let's actually start there because I did have a question about that, which I think that'd be a much better way to actually frame it. So, I'll ask that question instead. So, I know you've been on an extensive journey with chronic pain following a head injury that happened a few years ago, and now you've got things to a manageable place for a serious amount of self-education and work. So can you describe your journey with chronic pain and share anything that may be useful for someone suffering with chronic pain to hear?
Yes. I think that's a good point, isn't it? Because then it sets a bit of context. Okay, so had the brain injury in 2011, a couple of weeks before I started the OT course. So if anyone ever has an ABI, acquired brain injury, go and do an undergraduate degree, that will force your brain to have neuroplasticity. I'm not actually joking about that. I actually solidly do believe that. A lot of error. Repeat errors, you know, that's where neuroplasticity can actually happen. Repeat errors and repetitions. Anyway, so long story short is gradually over time, because I've been very much into exercise and fitness because I was very overweight as a child and heavily bullied as a child in relation to what I looked like. And I still have a lot of underlying trauma and insecurities about that, but that's a whole other subject. So chronic pain, what happened was that I was getting these niggling sort of, you know, the typical things like, my knees hurt, and my neck hurts, and and then I started to get it actually after I moved here. So back in 2015, when I moved to Sydney, I really started to get these intense feelings in my neck and my shoulders. And then that kind of continued down to my hips and then into my feet. And my hands, actually, no, that's where I've got it now, is hands. But I had not been taught or been told what I honestly still thought the biomedical model was, because I didn't know anything about pain. I think that's a big issue, is that people need to know about pain science, because the biomedical model is, muscle imbalances. And I'm not saying these models are wrong. I'm not saying, if you think muscle imbalance, you're stupid. But again, there doesn't have to be one model. There doesn't have to be one paradigm, does there? You don't have to sign up to one model of like pain. So with me, it just got worse and worse. And I was going to see the stereotypical get on the plinth. Plinth? Is that the right thing? You know, the massage table? Is that a plinth?
Of sorts, I suppose. Massage table? We'll call it
a plinth. Wasn't a chin.
Get on the plinth.
You know, whatever. The thing where they just jam needles in you. And I was going to see very stereotypical sort of, you've got a weak core, and you've got a tight muscle, and you've got a muscle imbalance, like a lot of deep tissue massages and dry needling. And I was going to see lots of people, and it was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I was like, it must be because I'm not sitting up straight. It must be because I'm sitting down too much. It must be because my hips have got tight, like this really, and again, I'm not saying these are incorrect. I'm just saying I wasn't using that holistic mindset to understand the complexity of pain because I'd never been taught it. So it got worse and worse and worse. My mental health, which I now realize was probably a massive factor why my pain was getting worse. I thought that if I did more exercise or engaged in more activities, which was obviously a meaningful occupation, it was making it worse. I was damaging my body because the biomedical model is, don't lift anything. Don't bend over. Rest, bed rest. As we know, possibly one of the worst things you can possibly do with chronic pain is just like don't move and be in really weird postures laid on the sofa or like in the US, here you go, have some really strong opioids. That will sort you out. I was actually watching that program I was talking to you about last night, Dope Sick, which is giving a really clear view of how the OxyContin and opioid crisis started. And I'm so happy that here in Australia, they don't dish them out like sweets, because that could have been a very dark path for me. Anyway, so long story short, it got worse and worse and worse. I had loads of time off work. I actually got to the point where I was suicidal. I stood on a bridge one night over six lanes of traffic and I was like, my life is done. I was like 33, 34. I was like, this is it. My life's done. What's the point? I can't do what I want to do. Because I think the other thing was fitness and exercise in my mind had very much been tied with a feeling of self-worth, because I'd grown up feeling very insecure, very, you know, bullied, feeling that I was disgusting and horrible. And I started doing exercise. I was like, wow, I've got muscles and people give me compliments and I feel good. And I was like, that's it. My life's over. I can't do that anymore. I can't do it anymore. And I literally stood on a bridge one night because I'd gone to see some bullshit. Sorry for swearing, but some bullshit specialist. Oh, this now I just, I wish I could just, I don't really like fighting people anymore, but I wish I would just walk up to this guy and just headbutt him because he's such a dick. Yeah, it's, I've heard you bastard. It was like a specialist sports doctor. And, you know, anytime there's the word specialist, you're like, this person's probably going to be a complete tool. And his thing was like, gave me like injections and like got an MRI done. Because I still had in my mind that MRI equals, oh, there's damage on the MRI. So that must mean there's damage and pain. He's basically, his advice, I broke down in the session. I was like, I started crying. I was like, I cannot deal with this. I cannot have this go on. I need to live my life. And he kind of just looked like, just don't do exercise then. And that was it. And then just kicked me out the door. And I was like, well, he didn't kick me out, but it was like, done. And I remember just being like, and that was the day I'd stood on that bridge and I was looking down at the six lanes of traffic. I'm just like, I'm just going to throw myself off. Thankfully, I didn't. Thank God. Or thank whatever God you believe in. And then through my work, because I was working with a psychologist. So again, you know, these conversations you have with people. So where I worked, it was like, we're trauma focused and trauma aware. They're actually basically a cult of some degree. And they pretty much traumatize their staff. But that's normally the case, isn't it? We're anti-trauma, but we traumatize people. And then I had a conversation with one of the psychologists. And he told me that he'd had such intense. So if you can imagine here, just anyone that's listening, is his hands had clawed, like almost gone like claws, had gone completely white, like literally were like dead hands, basically curled up, was diagnosed as having arthritis. He was in his 20s. And he's like, your hands are screwed. Medication, typical like MRI, oh, there's damage in your hands. There's damage. I know. It's a lifelong condition. I have to take meds. Put on tons of weight, lost tons of self-esteem. And long story short, had this idea where they were like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm not going to take these meds anymore. Within 3, 4, 6 months, hands had like basically gone back to whatever normal is. Normal, fully functional, no restrictions, no pain. Pain every now and again. And I remember that again. I broke down and just cried. And he's like, mate, it's fine. It's fine. Just like chronic pain is complex. And maybe use your really good clinical skills to go and learn about pain and apply it to yourself. From there, one video clip, again, I just kept crying. Because this is the thing, I don't have any like reserve. Sorry, sticking your finger up, what do you want?
Yeah, I just jump in there and want to say how many slippery slopes there are when it comes to this kind of thing with you know, you're saying about, okay, there's damage on the MRI, that's definitely causing the pain, but like, is it? You know, that we still don't know about pain. There's so much that we do not know. It is not a linear thing. And I think you can get into some really dangerous territory, especially when there are drugs involved, when there's like a blanket diagnosis made and drugs administered without, say, asking the person what their diet is like, how are they sleeping, how much water are they drinking, what are their stress levels like, do they have social connections, how happy are they within their life, you know, and it can be because these kinds of things or the lack of these things or doing these things incorrectly can hypersensitize the nervous system. A hypersensitized nervous system is going to be a nervous system that is more likely to be in a lot more pain. As we desensitize the nervous system by working on these various different lifestyle aspects, this then often reduces the pain without you necessarily even knowing what's causing the pain, because often we think we know what's causing the pain, but you know, I always have this in the back of my mind when I'm working with a client. It's just like, right, okay, we're looking at the pain, it's looking like this, but it's only ever a theory. Because you can never really say for sure, because pain is there's still so much we don't know about it. So yeah, I just wanted to
That's a really good point. But I'll just say, I recommend this to every single client or person, literally anybody, because now I'm a massive, even if I just bump into people probably think, I don't want to meet that Gavin guy at party. He's a bloody nightmare. He's telling me about pain science. But if someone says, oh, I've had really bad back pain or neck pain, or I'm going in for surgery because I've got back pain, I'm like, well, hang on a sec. Obviously, you know your body better than I do, because I'm just some random dude you're meeting at a party who's probably had too many beers. But check out this. So I always recommend to people is Taming the Beast. It's a clip on YouTube by someone by the name of Laura Mosley, who's one of the world's most well-known and well-respected pain science researchers. Him and David Butler wrote Pain Explain, Explain Pain and Explain Pain Supercharged. And Supercharged is for designed for clinicians. That's the book I showed you the cover of earlier. It's not easy reading, but I'm dedicated to try and learn. So, and that basically goes in, it's like an animated, really simplistic thing of, and in that video clip, it says that pain, I'm probably bastardizing this, pain does not equate to tissue damage.
Mm-hmm.
Or it does not necessarily. Again, it's that complexity of, and I was like, oh my God, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm broken. It means that maybe there's something else going on here. And from that day onwards, I think the next day I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I started doing press-ups again. I started doing pull-ups. And I was like, okay, this isn't great, but my arm hasn't fallen off. I started going out, I started using my bike again. But what I really did was I then realized that probably all the things you mentioned, and then this is leading on to that biopsychosocial approach, which I've been taught at uni, but had not been applying to myself when it comes to pain. I've been with that biomedical model where you're told you're broken. It's a bit like, this is the common medical model, isn't it? That, okay, there's something wrong with your body or your brain or whatever. We're going to fix it. We're going to fix you. And that is what we're often taught when we're in training, like OT, not 100%, but it was assessment, planning, intervention, outcome measure, next. And then, you know, you go in and you're like, yeah, okay, great. I can be this really like dogmatic person. I know best. Yeah, I'm amazing. I've got all this knowledge. And then you go into the real world and you're like, ah, crap. I've done everything I was told and it's not fixing the person. I think that can be that fixed mentality, because I think most people that go into these types of professions, we want to help people, but then we can become this kind of, I know best, I'm going to fix you. And what I realized with the pain stuff was you can't really be fixed. I still have chronic pain now, but I don't catastrophize it. I you know, at the moment I've got pain in my hands. So again, as you know, pain can move to different parts of the body. But I think that's where a definition of the biopsychosocial model is really important, because it gives this wider kind of viewpoint. So I actually wrote down out of Explain Pain Supercharged, because I knew you were going to ask me. So this is a quote. I'm pretty sure it's either David.
Just before we go to biopsychosocial, mm-hmm. just want to just to add something to that. And it's this fixing mentality, which is, I think, one of the biggest issues with many of the industries, because when a client and patient goes to someone to fix them, there's this mental responsibility handover. So it's almost like the parent going to the child and, you know, okay, I've got my problem. Now it's your responsibility to deal with. So then I don't necessarily have to take responsibility for my own health, because I'm just going to come to the table, be passive and get fixed. And then this totally takes away, in many cases, I think, the opportunity for people to do exactly what you've done, and take the helm, take the horns, and take responsibility and do your education to ultimately get things to a much better place. So, and you know, it's really interesting how literally that was the turning point where this person said to you, oh, use your clinical skills to educate yourself. And that was the U-turn for you. You know, it was, and you could maybe say it's because that was the first time that it was kind of moving out of the fixer paradigm and into the self-empowerment paradigm, which is, I think, a lot of therapies get it and don't quite hit the mark.
And a lot of us are still trained under the biomedical model, whether we realize it or not. You know, I often talk to a lot of people who, and I think it can be really easy to look at other professions as think, bleh, bullshit, bleh, fucking bleh, bullshit, what's that? Bleh, that's not that dogmatic thinking. Oh, this person who studied this, bleh, they haven't got a bloody clue. A lot of the physios I went to see, for example, not bashing physios, I actually have thought about doing a master's in physio, and then I've kind of thought, do I really want to do a master's? Probably not necessarily just because it's physio. But again, that's often a biomedical. So there's old paradigms. There's lecturers like speech pathologists, occupational therapists. As soon as there's and that biomedical like fix. So this is where I'm going to go into the biopsychosocial, because it gives you this idea of how our upbringing, our beliefs, our culture, you know, all of us, the elephant in the room is we live in a world where the allopathic medicine has been in our minds, subconsciously or consciously, our whole lives. You're a kid. Oh, you're not feeling well. Oh, you've got a sore throat. Not like maybe let's think about what your sleep's like or some movement or getting outside or all that type of stuff. Here you go. Have this really strong cough syrup that's got codeine in it to make you dependent on codeine, which is can be very strong, but not as strong as something else. That's basically an opioid. Here you go. Here's an external regulator. Rather than the fact you've got your endorphin system, which is a natural, and David Butler calls it the internal drug cabinet. We've got all the drugs we could possibly take in our own system. But here's this quote. So it's either Lorimer Moseley or David Butler. Not quite sure. But so let me see if I can actually read this out without stumbling, because I normally do. Pain involves the intricate variable interaction of biological factors, genetic, biomechanical, etc., psychological factors, mood, personality, behavior, and social factors, cultural, familial, socioeconomic, medical, etc. That's it.
Solid quote.
Because that's, and then should we unpack what that might mean? Because there's a lot in that, but I'm just going to read it once more because I want this to go into people's minds. Because if anyone's listening to this, maybe there's someone that's dealing with chronic persistent pain or a mental health issue, because this applies to everything. This isn't just chronic pain. Like, this applies to literally our whole lives, that holistic, broad thinking way of thinking about things. So pain involves the intricate, variable interaction of biological factors, genetic, biomechanical, etc., psychological factors, mood, personality, behavior, etc., and social factors, cultural, familial, socioeconomic, medical, etc. So what I think is really important is, and you know, the pain science education, when we say biopsychosocial, that doesn't mean that it's just one or the other. It means that it can be a collection, and it will be a variable. All the variables will be a collection, sorry to rephrase that, of all of those. It doesn't mean, oh, it's either biomechanical or it's psychological. It's like it's probably biomechanical, genetic, psychological, your mood, your beliefs, like how you're raised to believe that some people's like, oh, you're sick. And that's what we have with the allopathic medicine system. And, you know, definitely the current world we're in is like, there's a quick fix. A certain thing will fix all your problems. Don't worry. And anyone that doesn't decide to have that fix needs to be kept out of society because they're a danger. And we know what we're talking about. But even talking about it, we're not allowed to talk about it. We're not allowed to have these conversations. And I think pain is one of these ones where I just wish that just people could just watch that, like kids be taught about pain. Like I know there is people out there doing this, like going into schools. I heard this amazing, I listened to a lot of podcasts about physios and OTs and stuff going into schools and teaching kids basic pain science stuff. It's like maybe do some breath work to regulate your nervous system because your nervous system and your endocrine system, and your musculoskeletal system and all your different systems are interrelated. And actually, you can have some influence over that through lifestyle and breath work and sleep. But it's like, no, just take a tablet. And then the tablet or whatever then has a side effect, or the biggest placebo ever is surgery. But we're getting towards the end of our time, so that's a whole other conversation to have. So has that kind of, I really like that definition. And I think if someone doesn't necessarily know what the biopsychosocial model is, it can be a bit confusing. But it basically it's saying, look, things are really complicated. And if you're a clinician or a practitioner, you need to not have that fixed mentality, because like you very wisely said, you don't know. There's this idea that science has worked everything out. That's not how science works. It's not like we're following the science. Science is it's not a religion. It's a continuous hypothesis, test, analysis, retest. That's how science is. It's not a religion.
That's what science is supposed to be like, but many sects of science are actually a bit more religious at the moment.
Oh, I found this research study that says this. It's like, yeah, but have you actually read the study? That's what really does my nut in, because there's a lot of armchair experts.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've decided that if you eat meat, and then this very blanket demonization. So I don't quite know how this has happened, but I then have heard people say, well, if you're anti V word for vendetta, then you're right wing and racist. And I'm like, how the fuck did that happen? I am definitely not right wing and racist, but how has that suddenly happened? How am I now racist? Because full transparency, I'm actually doing the V word because I literally have been mandated to, and I resisted as long as possible. But that doesn't mean I'm now like, well, it was the best thing ever, and everyone that doesn't do it is a dickhead, and fuck them and keep them out of society. Blah. So I know this is the tail end of the podcast, and this is a whole can of worms to open, but I think it's,
I think it's been, my God bless me, one of the most complex issues we've faced. Yeah, I think as a human species, and it is a billion shades of grey, but it's made to be of being black and white.
Yes,
and I think this is the big issue with that particular issue. I just want to cycle back just a little bit and on biopsychosocial, and I'd love to hear like a little bit of unpacking in regards to the psychological. Mm-hmm. Mental, emotional links to pain, because not everyone might be familiar with those, with the particular correlation, because there's some really great movements happening at the moment, and it's becoming a lot more in the forefront of the consciousness that there isn't a link from the mental, emotional system to pain in the body. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear an example from yourself, and then I'll give an example that I might see as well. What are your thoughts and feelings on that, mate?
So there's this common thing of stress. So it's now kind of almost acknowledged and understood that stress, which is a very blanket term for many things, because we know stress can actually be positive, because it's not just being overworked. You can actually have those hormetic stresses like cold exposure, saunas, exercise, that's a hormetic stressor. Fasting, that's a hormetic stressor. But the idea that all stress is bad, again, there's nuance to everything, isn't there? And there's sometimes like, stress is bad. But these long-term periods of being overwhelmed, you know, your sleep suffering, you're not making great food choices. Because as we know, what is the foundation of health? Sleep, which often gets ignored. It's like, oh, no, I'll sleep while I'm dead. Well, you'll probably die sooner then, if that's your mindset. And, you know, that was definitely something which I had for a long time. I was like, oh, sleep, waste of time, innit? It's just closing your eyes. Wrong. I wouldn't say wrong. I wasn't as informed, because I don't like saying wrong or right. Mm. So with the psychological factors is, again, like I said, it's an integrated system of systems, as you know very well. But your nervous system And then there's the simplification of, you know, sympathetic, parasympathetic. So sympathetic, fight, flight, hypervigilance, panic, anxiety, freeze. Also another one, fawn, which I really like that definition. Fawn is that essentially because of your upbringing, your attachment model as a child, which is then it goes into the work of a lot of the developmental psychologists, because we were all children once, unless we're an orc, and then we just popped out of a rock or from underneath a rock. And this I have not been a child. I just want pain science flesh. more pain explained. Let's go. This idea that I've just gone off a total tangent there.
Back on the menu, boys.
Pain, back on the menu. Let's give someone surgery. Let's get them OxyContin and surgery. Medical model. So that sympathetic, so the fight flight, as we know, that can have that flood of adrenaline, or as I found out, if it's in the brain, it's called neuroadrenaline or norepinephrine, if I can pronounce it right. It's like, no, adrenaline in the body and the brain is different. It's like, is it really? Or are they just, again, continuing that, well, it's separate. Well, no, it's not. It's a system of systems connected by the vagus nerve. But then you can have that parasympathetic, you know, rest, digest, feed and breed. But also the suggestion that you can then have those extreme parasympathetic shutdown, disassociation, collapse. That's a very much a ancient part of our brain and body. And, you know, again, this isn't, again, nothing is ever set in stone, but if people are interested, check out Stephen Porges' work, polyvagal theory. I've actually got a polyvagal flip chart thing, which I use in sessions with clients to explain the nerve system. Anyway, if you then think about it, is if you're having this flood of neurotransmitters and hormones, and literally your musculoskeletal system is like tensing up, you then can be,
mental emotional stress. Yeah.
Yeah, mental emotional stress can then lead to, again, I don't know quite know why there was that separation. I guess it's like the brain and the body and your thoughts have nothing in relation to your body. And you're like, if I'm stressed, as in for like many reasons why, and we all have a different pain dial or pain stress dial. Imagine that in like a radio station. It's like sometimes the signal's bad and sometimes it's like super clear. Again, that's all dependent on our background, that biopsychosocial model. It's never just one thing. One thing I really can't stand is when clients or support workers, families or whatever, not support workers, families, support clients, families or support workers, whatever, like, well, I don't feel depressed. So I don't get why they're depressed or I'm not in pain. So get over it. It's like, that's not really empathic. But if we then think about, we can have the different types of pain. Thinking about flying back to England, different types of pain. And, you know, that can be very much reliant on our emotional and psychological state. Because if we're in a panic state, if we're in an overwhelmed state, if we're having all those effects on all of our foundations of health, the pain can be increased. And then the problem is the social factor of that is we're taught pain equals something that needs to be fixed. And that's not really explicit. It's implicit from childhood. Oh, you've hurt yourself. Sit down. Take a tablet. Everything will be okay. Oh, you've got a sore throat. Oh, you're in pain. Here you go. Here's some cough syrup. So, and then we grow up knowing, my granddad, oh, I've got really bad back, a bad back. Oh, yeah, bad back. Oh, yeah, I've got to go in for surgery on my back. And I'm like, so we've got this in our minds that actually pain equals damage. And we're never told that explicitly, but we're taught from a very young age, like that cultural belief is that, and you go to the doctor and they go, okay, here's a prescription, fix. Again, that fix biomedical mindset. So when we then feel stressed, when we feel we're in pain, we're like, oh my God, something's damaged. Oh my God, something's damaged. And like we spoke about a fair while ago was, you know, the video where it's like, don't ever bend forwards. One of your discs will like explode like a donut firing jam all over the place. And you're like, oh God, oh, that work health is don't bend over, don't pick things
up. Let's live in fear.
Let's be terrified. And then you've got that hypervigilance of, oh my God, I've got a pain. Oh my God, there's something damaged. Oh my God. And then you go to a clinician and they go, okay, we'll move this. I'll jab some needles in there. okay, you should be fixed. And then a day later, you're like, come back. And they're like, all right, let's do another treatment. And you're like, okay, that's gone. Excellent. Oh, God, it's back. And that can be where that chronic pain, slippery slope, and some people have extreme pain. But like I was saying, this is why I think podcasts like this and discussions like this, and why I love David Butler and Laura Mosley's work and someone by the name of Peter O'Sullivan and all the other pain researchers that are doing their pain science research, but then turning into easily digestible things. Because us as clinicians, I can sit and read Explain Pain Supercharged and polyvagal theory books and all that stuff. But actually educating the people that are experiencing these every day of their life is so important. But the biomedical model just continues that perpetual thing of stress, how you feel. You've got 7 minutes with a doctor. What? I don't want to talk to you about how you feel. I'm going to write you a script. Bye.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
that was a massive rant there, but
it's all good. We love the rants, mate. Yeah, I mean, like from my experience working with guys, you know, I'll assess someone for a minimum of an hour and a half before I even do anything. It's often a lot longer than that. Complex cases is 3 to 3.5 hours, then like looking very deep at what's happening within the organ health as well, and then you can start to build nothing more than a theory. It's nothing for sure, although the more education you have, the better theories you can create. And you know, so I see so many of people's pain challenges are rooted in the psychology. So, you know, if someone is going through a breakup, or they've lost a loved one, or they're having a really difficult time at work, you know, to give like an example of how it could create pain in the body is like, this activates the fight or flight response, and then this could activate, let's say, the hip flexors, because the hip flexors are some of our fight or flight muscles, our primary run away or kick something fight muscles. Mm-hmm. Chronically, if these muscles are active for a very, very long time, because they connect to the back, then biomechanically they can potentially pull on the vertebrae, which can send the disc out and cause the back pain. And now, if you give this person painkillers, are you really helping them? No, you're actually, in fact, you're going to make things worse most likely, because they're going to have the pain dampened, and the pain is a warning signal or a teacher. In this particular example, not all examples, because pain isn't linear, but in this example, they'll dampen the pain receptors, which will be potentially dangerous, because then they're just going to drive themselves further into that place. And because the original stressor, which in this example is not always as linear as this, was the work challenge or the loss of the loved one or the, you know, and if the person hasn't resolved that root causation, then, you know, you're pissing in the wind, really.
Yeah. and that's really, so I don't know about you, but when I went into like clinical practice or practice, I just kept thinking, I have no fucking idea what I'm doing here. And I was constantly trying to find this last bit of training that would help me to understand everything. And 8, 9, 10 years into study and all that sort of stuff, I'm now at this point where I'm like, I really don't know jack shit. And I'm happy with that, because then that means that I can be open to different paradigms. I think that's really important for anyone. It's like, try not to just sign up to one paradigm. Don't just sign up to one model. Expose your mind and your soul and everything else in between that with different thinking. Like, I find it really difficult to deal with people that have this dogmatic thinking of, if you do eat animal products, and this is not dissing any vegans out there, I get wanting to not hurt animals, I get that 100%. I'll be eating meat and I'm like, I shouldn't eat meat, not as I shouldn't, but I can understand. I'm like, thank you animal for giving me your flesh, but well, not giving me, we forced you to, but I'm actually trying to find a place where I can get wild game. Like here in Australia, you can actually buy kangaroo and the meat is pretty tough, but at least it's natural. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But this idea that then there's this snowball thinking of, and I don't know if you know who Rob Wolf is. So Rob Wolf is someone who very much kind of created the, not really created, but was opened one of the first CrossFit gyms in the US. And he's he kind of created the idea of like paleo sort of eating, which is obviously a starting point. He's moved on a lot from that anyway. So he tells a story about how someone he knows and respects is that, you know, he was talking about this open conversation about carbon emissions, and a lot of I can't exactly remember, I think it's like something in the sea, like a certain type of organism that lets off a lot of carbon dioxide. And if the whole thing is like eradicate anything that gives out carbon dioxide, I think there'd been a suggestion of like get rid of them, destroy them, because they're putting out carbon dioxide. And then he's kind of like, well, I don't know if necessarily just like eradicating a whole organism is the best way to stop climate change. I think the biggest issues we've got is coal and gas and this whole mind skewing of, oh, well, the issue is cows farting. Really? Is it? Have you ever seen the emissions that are coming out of huge industries, which are normally way more damaging than cows farting? I mean, that's the insanity. But then this knock-on effect was that he then was told, well, if you don't want to, if you're a climate change denier, and he's like, well, I'm not a climate change, well, then you're a Holocaust denier.
Hey.
It's like, hang on a sec.
That escalated quickly.
That's gone really quick, really fast, isn't it? So I guess just trying to have this awareness that it feels good as a human to have that cognitive echo chamber, that confirmation bias, to be looking at it and be like, yeah, I've worked all this out. I've got all this. This one person, this guru knows. This one person's worked it all out. And that can be really reassuring because we're like, ah, this person. So I go through phases where I find someone who I really respect there. So at first it was someone by the name of Bessel van der Kolk. Amazing book. If anyone wants to understand the basics of what trauma is, read The Body Keeps the Score. And then it was someone by the name of Gabor Mate. Amazing book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. Recently it's been Andrew Huberman, like a neuroscientist from Stanford. Really interesting content. But the problem is I have to remind myself, don't idolize that person, because again, they're a human being. But and my mate summed this up really well. I was like, yeah, gurus, you got to watch out for gurus. And he just said this off, and he's not a clinician, he's like, mate, gurus are normally rapists. And I was like, I think that's a bit of a jump. But it doesn't that show how people can make these assumptions? It's like a guru doesn't have to be a rapist. They also don't have to be the answer to absolutely everything. So let's try and be a bit more humility and a bit more understanding that people can have things collected together, but it doesn't mean that one person's worked it all out. Let's stay open to discussion and, like you're saying, not just that black and white thinking.
Yeah, I think, I was just going to mention the black and white aspect of it, but also the isolated nature of the thinking. And it kind of brings us around full circle in a way to...
Yeah, let's finish up because we've gone well over an hour.
No, it's kind of brought us full circle because, you know, we started off this conversation by really talking about holistic. Mm-hmm. What is holistic and how you run a holistic practice. And I think a lot of what you're describing and kind of one of the themes of what we have been talking about that we haven't quite named is isolated thinking. And it's like the isolated thinking of thinking that one modality is the best modality, or the isolated thinking of just looking at the liver without taking into account what the rest of the system is happening, or the isolated thinking that is just looking at the shoulder pain as a biomechanical shoulder problem, where in actual fact it can be a myriad of other potential problems.
Yeah.
Or no, I don't even like the word problem really. But yeah, I think it's isolated black and white thinking that tends to get people in trouble. And I think when you are working with people, you cannot afford to be thinking in this way because it is, and treating people in this way because, you know, I see it. Oh man, everyone is so wildly, wildly different. It's just like, I think like within what we do, we have some of the most interesting, invigorating jobs in the world. It's not even a job to me. I'm sure it's not to you, but it's like when you see such a wildly different cases from day to day, there is no one approach. And if you try and do one approach with everyone, you miss so much. And also just because this certain approach worked fantastically with this person doesn't mean it's going to work fantastically with this person. I've had many times, I've had like, right, this has been amazing. Done a similar approach with this person. It's like virtually zero response. It's like, okay, right, let's go back to the drawing board. But how had I kept running with that same treatment, and had I not switched gears, then person B wouldn't have got to a better place. And yeah. I think it is this, and I think this is endemic of our kind of Western logical based left brain thinking. It's isolation, cutting everything up, you know, dividing, you know, Chek said something good once about the core muscles, and it's just, he was explaining the anatomy of the core muscles. And he said something like, yeah, these muscles only exist in isolation within academia. And what he was saying is the only place that these function as one muscle is in the fricking textbook teaching you about anatomy. And I think it's getting out of this thinking, which is going to help transform the way practitioners work across the world. And I think things are heading in a positive direction. What do you think of that, to kind of like a penultimate question?
I think that, and again, what really jumped into my mind there was, yeah, okay, core muscles don't exist in a silo. They don't exist in a vacuum of separation. Like you said, the Western medical model, the allopathic medical model, has really hyper-focused on understanding things down to the molecular level, which is obviously good to know, but actually it's like, take this supplement. Well, food, if it's good quality food, provides a very complex interplay of all the vitamins and minerals and all the things that you need. But just taking a vitamin C tablet is very different to taking something which contains vitamin C as a food. It's a completely different way of being processed. And that very much kind of like reductionist, oh, you have ADHD, that means you have a dopamine insufficiency. Here's some tablets that give you more dopamine. Or you have depression, we've speculated, because this is now heavily, heavily, heavily debated, you've got a serotonin imbalance. Take some tablets which are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It doesn't fix, because this is what I would say to clients, and I have them like burst into tears. Like, they'll say, I feel like I'm broken, and I feel like, you know, and I'm just, I say, can I just give them a potential like view on that? They say, yeah. And they just go, fuck off. But they go, yeah. And I say, have you ever thought that maybe you're not broken, so we don't need to fix you, you just need some help? And they're just like, and it's like a moment of silence. And I think what's really important to be aware of is that we get this idea, this individualistic neoliberal world that we live in. It's all about the individual, the individual, the individual. If you don't get better because you don't take your medication, that's your fault. If you don't get a job and you're given opportunities, your fault. If you don't do well in life, it's your fault. It's like the individual. And obviously an individual having choice and control and influence in their own life is very important, but we don't exist in a silo. Dan Siegel's book, Interpersonal Neurobiology, again, that's mega nerdy stuff that I read in my spare time. But like, we don't exist in a silo. We are an incredibly social being. We evolved in groups, but we're now kind of almost in these giant human zoos where we're kept separate from each other. It's like, oh, well, the reason why you're depressed, right, is because your serotonin levels aren't very high. So take this tablet, and if you don't take it, it's your fault. What about the fact the person might have gone through childhood trauma? They might be going through a bloody lockdown. They might have lost their job. They might have a terrible self-esteem. All these factors that tie in together, but then they're getting this narrative that they're broken and it's their fault. And if you can't pull up your bootstraps, you know, that toxic masculinity is a massive issue that we also have as well. That's the elephant in the room, is like, I don't think a lot of guys or people that identify as male are ready for it. It's like, what woofter? What need, like these really? And I've actually gone out on the line and talked to people about it, and it's almost like you still can't feel comfortable with actually being truthful and honest, because society teaches us that don't be weak, don't fail. Failures for weak people, like being a drug addict, junkie, like those horrible terms. And often the people that are hardcore drug users have gone through so much childhood trauma. Would you, and that's the thing is like, would you say to a child who's like being sexually, emotionally, physically, socially abused, 10 years down the line, they're on heroin or they're smoking crack or doing meth or whatever. Would you just think, just think of that little kid, that traumatized little kid 10 years down the line. You're like, piece of shit, you junkie. You deserve to die on the streets. It's like, how have we lost our humility so much? I know this is a wider thing, but we don't exist in a vacuum. We are a complex, biodynamic human organism, and we still haven't worked out how we really work because the science is never done. We can be led by the science, but the science is never done. Like I said, it's not meant to be a religion. But as you said, in conclusion, it's often being used as this is the only way. And if you don't adhere to this, then you deserve to be put on a cross and some nails put in your hands and a thorn crown put on.
Yeah,
rant number 10, done.
It was a powerful ass rant, my friend.
But you can tell that I think about this sort of stuff very broadly. And I think that having these conversations, I hope people then go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, this guy's a loon.
Yeah, I hope so. If this comes to only one person and they maybe think, come away with a different perspective, then it is well worth. Yeah. Even if no one, it is well worth just having this conversation anyway.
Yeah.
But hopefully someone's kind of listens to this because, you know, when it is kind of spelled out in the way of logic, then and in a certain way, the things that you said tonight, it is just like, oh, hang on. Yeah, no, we do have it. not in the right way. So
can I one thing I always like to do is, because I know that there's probably people listening to this that really like reading extra books. I've got a couple of books that I'd like to recommend for people to read.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I just say the first one? I know you probably people won't be able to see it, but this one, Notes on a Nervous Planet by Matt Haig. The back that is, the world is messing with our minds. What if there was something we could do about it? It's not clinical, it's not like jargony. It's basically a guy's journey through serious anxiety and suicidal ideation, and it's really well written. And if I'm ever feeling really burned out or worn out, I just have it by my bed and I'll read a few chapters. They're very short as well. Matt Walker's book, Why We Sleep. I know people have been like, oh, the data in there isn't good enough, and you know, people like to pick things apart, don't they? But actually, it's a lot easier to criticize than write your own bloody best-selling book. Why We Sleep by Matt Walker, The New Science of Sleep and Dreams, really important. And anyone that's interested in the pain stuff, if you're a person that wants to understand pain more, I would suggest reading Explain Pain by David Butler and Lorimer Moseley. And if you're a mega nerd like you and I, and you want to dive straight into the actual pain science for that extra level, Explain Pain Supercharged. And one last one, I promise. Tim Ferriss, The 4-Hour Work Week. Profound. Anyway.
Amazing. Thank you for the recommendations. I'll probably take a couple from there. So, yeah, rad. This has been really enjoyable, mate. Thank you so much for coming on. How can people find out more about you and Wizard OT, bud?
So, website is pretty good. So www.wizardot.com, and that is literally like a wizard, like Harry Potter or Gandalf. So it is literally a wizard.
Oh yeah, go on. Yeah.
Or on Instagram, so that's wizard_OT. Yeah, that's the best way to find Wizard OT. But I've spent a lot of time on that website and constantly trying to update it and keep it fresh and new. And yeah, that's probably the best way.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. You've done a good job, mate. You're doing a good job. Mate, have you noticed that we're rocking like Wizard OT and Phoenix Coaching? Like Dumbledore and his Phoenix.
I have thought that, and I'm like, This is where the stars align. We're on the other side of the planet. You're in the UK and I'm in Australia, but our minds are still
one.
Fantasy sci-fi weirdos. And also, a Dune film's coming out next month.
Bro, I saw it the other day. It was amazing.
Oh, don't. No, I can't go. I can't go to the cinema at the moment.
Okay. May is next level. They've done a very, very good job. Like, it's epic. I saw it in the IMAX for the first time. It was just... So for anyone listening, read Dune. Like, read it. If you can read it before you see it in the cinema, then do so. If not, that's cool. Read it anyway. It's an absolute gem. It's the science fiction Lord of the Rings, and something that me and my good friend Gar here love.
I'm actually trying to reread the trilogy in time to go and watch it at the cinema. I'm like, I've got to read it. But it's like the thick trilogy where it looks like a phone book that cops would beat someone to death with.
Don't worry about that, mate. They cut off halfway through the first book.
Oh, right.
It's too big for one film. Well, I'm glad they did it, right? Because it's way too... Remember the 1984 version? It just got rushed in all the best...
David books. Lynch, yeah.
It's good. But they've done a badass job of it. The ornithopters are amazing, mate. In fact,
to anyone that's listening, we're going to stop this recording bit now because people are like, what the fuck are they talking about? But thank you so much for this opportunity. And it's been really good to chew the fat with you because I often, and your comment about you've seen my journey, you've seen what I've done. I think it's difficult to then, and likewise with you, 100%, where it's like, maybe both of us weren't really having the best time in our lives and we really made that conscious decision to change things. And, you know, it just turns out that actually what brings us meaning is helping people. And, yeah, that's it. Boom. Drop the mic.
I couldn't think of a better way to end it. And I love you, mate.
Thanks. Oh. Now stop the recording.
All right. Peace, mate. Peace out. Thank you so much. And see you soon.